I'm not butting in.
Shoot.
Tom Clammer, who has a excellent show on KKFI, has collected a lot of information, interviews, and so forth about the Kansas City plant here that makes nuclear bomb. I know he would like to pull all that together to in a book, and I at times have told him I'm going to help him find a grant to help him. Do you know, do you have any tidbits of wisdom on how to get a grant to do such a thing?
Granting bodies tend not to promote nuclear issues if it's critical.
Right.
And the answer is no, I don't know. But okay. Here's the deal.
Because you got a grant for your book, right?
That was it, from Canada. Uh-huh. So I don't know if Canada would subsidize a totally American.
Right.
But this, you know, it's the publishing system has so changed now with self-publishing and printing on demand.
Right.
That means you can lay it out and print one copy.
Uh-huh.
And it's not expensive. What you need is someone who knows how to design a book, you know,
uh-huh.
on a computer,
uh-huh.
Relating images and text. So he can do all of that work with his material,
uh-huh.
print a copy, and then he'll have something to show to publishers.
Uh-huh.
But no, I don't know the American granting system.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Except that nuclear issues are not looked upon with much favor.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But he should go the self-publishing route would be, I think, the way to go.
Self-publishing.
Robert Einstein said everything has changed but our way of thinking, and we're still caught in that dilemma of, you know, we have information, we know this is destructive of our entire planet. It can be, you know, the end of civilization, and yet, is it denial? Is it fear? Why are people not making more progress? I mean, I think, you know, as you lay out your case, people, you know, see, well, it's crazy just to continue to build and modernize weaponry.
But so much energy has gone into keeping people asleep or numb or pacified or confident that this is the way to go. I mean, a huge amount, the language, everything, because there's so much at stake. The money is bottomless pit of money, the addiction is deep, and they've got just enough of the right kind of justification for it. You know, we have to maintain, we have to be safe. It doesn't add up, of course. You can't be safe when everybody has one. And also, you don't let anybody else have one because you're the good person, so you get to have one, but bad people don't get to have one. These weapons so transcend those categories of good and evil. They're way beyond that. But they're fit into the shoebox of good and evil. And that's one of the things Einstein meant. Our mode of thinking hasn't changed. We're speaking the old way. But these things require a completely different mode of thinking, and that's the challenge. But you've got so many forces, you know, dedicated big time to moving it forward. It's just, it's awesome. So what do you do, you know? You can't do nothing, but you never know what your effort will lead to. You just don't. So, you know, you do what appeals to you. Jonathan Schell, the great writer of nuclear issues, said, taking on the nuclear issue is like climbing up the sheer face of a cliff. No two people do it the same way. You pick a little twig and you find a little ledge and you inch your way forward. And by the time you make progress, somebody else is like doing it way over here their own way. Everybody does it their own way. I really liked his description. That was certainly my experience. So, but the key is that you pick something that is meaningful to you. For me, making pictures. I'm not a person, I don't like to carry placards and march, but I love taking photographs. So for me, if I didn't take photographs, I don't know how I'd relate to it. But taking photographs was perfect for me. So that's what I still do. So find, you know, what your heart is pointing you at, and just go after that, and you have to give up all hope of of results. That's important too.
You used the example of Moses and the tablets and so forth. But you know, there was that Exodus and the people screamed and hollered, you know, you're leaving us in the desert for 40 years and whatever. But you would think that there would be a worldwide exodus from these weapons.
Well, that's why that referendum that is starting in Kansas City today, worldwide referendum, are you for or against nuclear weapons? Very simple. Mm-hmm. Do that. Let's see what the numbers are. That would be worth something. It really would, because it's never happened.
Could you elaborate on that? That's it.
Are you in favor of or against nuclear weapons?
Is this something you're starting, or who's?
No, it came up in the question period today. And I thought
I think the main problem is that most people theoretically are opposed to it, right? But they don't know how to deal with.
Well, that's a different issue.
So when you ask that question and you think it through thoroughly, you go, well, you're overwhelming. I don't know, because what do you do?
But that's a different question.
What are the alternatives?
That's another question. That would happen next.
Right.
It would, but I think it would stymie people in finding an answer to that question.
Well, I might stymie some people, but I think...
Oh, yeah, well, I don't mind. I'm just saying, I think there'd be a lot of people say, I don't know, instead of being willing to commit to...
But wouldn't you be curious to know how many people on this earth are against nuclear weapons? I'd like to know what the number is. Because, the guy asked, he says, how do you explain that... So many people are in favor of nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
That was his question. And I said, well, actually, we don't know how many people. We know the people who have the power, they're for it, but they're few.
And it'd be interesting to see how much difference is between weapons and energy.
Nuclear?
Because, you know, the waste is an issue. Nuclear energy and nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
The waste is still a major issue.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. It's the same for bombs as well as for this.
What about the people that are working in these plants? Are they doing this because there aren't other jobs, or is the pay good, or what?
Pay is good, and it is a
job. And so is that how they attract all the workers? Because I would think you'd be nervous about...
I think it's a whole range of emotions, really. I think people have mixed feelings, or people don't, or it's a job. I went into these bomb factories, and at first I was afraid. I thought, oh, it's evil, you know, Darth Vader. And I never found Darth Vader. I found people who had jobs, big grins, and, hi, how you doing? It just seemed all very normal. People get used to just about anything. And if you're making widgets, that's all they have to do. You know, they don't... The people in the factories that I talked to, they said, where else have you been? And I'd say some of the places, they say, wow, what was it like? You know, nobody sees the whole picture. They don't get to go to the other plants and see Los Alamos or see, you know, Savannah River plant. They don't. So I had a plan, a reparation plan for all people. All nuclear weapons designers should be forced through public service and to go and visit all the bomb factories and talk to all the workers and to get down in the ground in the trenches and talk to people and learn what's happening. They should be made to do that. And of course they don't. They sit and they theorize about abstract concepts and come up with all kinds of weapons ideas. But I think you can bet that there's a full spectrum of human emotion for people who work inside nuclear power plants, nuclear weapons plants like Bendix. It'd be very interesting to do a study. I mean, that would make probably a very interesting piece of literature. You know who'd be good at that would be Studs Terkel. That was his specialty. You know, he was going working American, is at work. He interviewed me once. We had a good time. I was very nervous, and it was very easy to talk to him, it turned out.
Oh, of course.
Yeah, he's great. But that's what, if you're talking about anthropology now, you know, go in there and see, what do you feel? Of course, people will be hesitant to talk if it means that they're going to lose their job.
Hmm. For a time, a local person, Jim Hanna, went out to the nuclear weapons parts plant, and he had a sign, is it good for the children? And he would do it, I think, every Monday or Tuesday from 7 to 9 or so, as people were, like, driving in. And occasionally someone would stop by, you know, and visit him, but mainly the people would just be beelining into, you know, the plant. And some would wave, but you know, they were like focused on, well, this is my bread and butter, you know, and they kind of compartmentalize and turn things off. So.
Yeah, no need to know is a big thing.
Yeah.
You have no need to know what the person two cubicles down is doing, so don't even ask.
I know someone here in town who's mother worked at the weapons plant here, and because of that, look, I don't even want to go into that. My mother worked there, you know, not even present tense stuff, but you know, to somehow to go against that plant would be to go against my mother, kind of thing.
Yeah.
And besides compartmentalizing, I think everybody has a degree of hubris.
Degree of what?
Hubris.
Pride.
We are such fabulous creatures as Homo sapiens. Mm-hmm. We can work through it.
Mm.
We can make it all right because we're so special. We've gotten this far. We can overcome the nuclear just like we can overcome carbon pollution.
Polio.
Yeah. Only we did do that one.
I wonder if you know, or if anyone is aware, this is a guy that has a film out about what went on in St. Louis in terms of that's where like nuclear waste was stored.
Yes.
And
yes. Big time. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you know much about that, or?
I've been there. I photographed the sites that are there. There's stuff there from the first days of the bomb from the Manhattan
right.
Project. There's waste there. I said, what's in here? And I said, oh. It's stuff from the Manhattan Project, in mounds, under tarps. They're still like, you know, shuffling it around. It doesn't, because it doesn't go away.
And there's natural movement in that area that's near St. Louis.
Yeah,
it's like in St. Louis, right?
Yeah, in St. Louis. Mallinckrodt did some of the first work with uranium, and that's all contaminated, and there's a lot of stuff there on by the airport. There's a lot of waste. It's on a water plane, and it's leaching.
The
leaking.
Water plane, yeah.
Yeah. Well, everywhere you go, though, everywhere you look, it's a kind of a nightmare. But people don't tend not to talk about it, and they cover it over and do quick fixes. But the longevity of this stuff, it's just got everybody. what can you do? We have never had this kind of problem as a species. Never. Pyramids are 5,000 years old, and that's not much time for nuclear waste.
Yeah.
But yeah, St. Louis is big. It was very active in the earliest days of the Manhattan Project.
Questions? Any other questions?
I'm interested, and thank you for your presentation and coming. It's good to see you again. I saw you at Naropa.
Oh,
when
was
that? Nuclear guardianship with Joanna Macy.
Yes, I remember that. Yeah.
Kaiser Hill and the cleanup at Rocky Flats coming in, were they invited in? Did they do a study on, in addition to running along government, the $37 billion and the 37 years, and then all of a sudden then they had the 3 years? Is that, who is Kaiser Hill?
Big contractor. That works with the nuclear industry. You could look them up. I don't know too many details about it, and I also don't know the process. People put in bids and things, and I don't know the dynamics of that. But they did a terrible job, you know. I mean, they left behind so much radioactivity, and called it a cleanup, and everybody said, okay, it's open use now for the land. They gave a big chunk of it to Fish and Wildlife, and they talk about, you know, having nature paths and people walking along them and burning the grass and all kinds of stuff. But I don't know too much about Kaiser Hill, so if you want to know about them, you would have to ask somebody else, or maybe just probably look them up and Google. And they're a big corporation, and they did have done a lot of work with the Department of Energy. I know that much.
You just wonder if there's some collusion where companies are low ball bidders, whatever, and the public is kind of relieved to say, oh, somebody's doing something out there. But
It's all for
situation normal.
So, but you know what happened? Well, how Rocky Flats got shut down in the first place is the FBI did an unannounced raid on Rocky Flats because there were so many allegations of environmental crimes, and they shut the place down, and it never restarted again after that. So that was an epical moment in the history of that facility. They were burning the incinerator against the law, and all kinds of long-term things. Their monitoring equipment didn't work, but they say it's fine. You know, that we don't have any records of any releases, but that's the word. They don't have the record of the release. That doesn't mean there weren't any releases. So anyway, there was this big FBI raid, and they shut it down. And then 10 years later, they're getting around to talking about the cleanup. These things move glacially, you know. And then they clean it up in 3 years, and there's stuff out there they don't know. And they made a rule, okay, about the contamination. They said it could be a certain amount within an inch, and then down to 4 feet, it can be this much. But after 6 feet, it doesn't matter. So what they did is they buried all kinds of stuff, mm-hmm. and nobody knows what they buried out there under 6 feet, which is beyond regulatory control. They buried whole buildings, apparently. So it's a terrible thing, and it's par for the course. But that plant is one of the worst plants because the material is so toxic, and that ground there, high winds, and all kinds of critters, animals digging in, ants and gophers and things, and bringing it all up to the surface. They did a study on the wildlife there, and there's a lot of movement of the soil from under the surface to the top, and the winds come and take it away. So it sounds like awful bad news, but I just think it's so important to just find out what is going on. What's the story here?
Do you know if NIH funds any ecological studies in those areas?
NIH, National Institute of Health?
Right. In terms of,
the people who have done the important health work have gotten fired for it. Carl Johnson is the one who made, was responsible for that red map that I did. That was years of work. And the government, they were taking samples too, but they would take samples of like 3 inches of soil and measure how much plutonium was there. What they're doing is averaging out the stuff that's on the surface with the stuff that's 3 inches down, which is less. So they got very low readings, but Carl Johnson said, no, let's just measure the respirable dust, just the stuff that's right on the surface. Let's see, because that's what blows around, that's the hazard. So that was the basis. He measured that, and the other people wouldn't touch it because they knew. The government agencies, their job is to come up with low numbers. It just is. And so he did this heroic work, and a couple of other people followed his trail. But it's the same old story of activism. You know, it takes courageous activists to go out there, ask the right questions, and do that kind of work in the trenches. And Rocky Flats is a really good example of that. But that map has been ignored. I mean, now they're building homes.
Obviously. Right. I'm thinking these are huge homes. These are
400,000. Big, very.
So these are people that make over the average income that are buying.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. But, I mean, Denver housing is probably fairly expensive, so I'm trying to get out of Kansas City. But
it's very scenic. It's right up against the foothills.
Yeah, well, you know, Front Range
well,
and Longs.
Well, they should suffer, too.
Well, and that's the interesting just the thing about people. It. Well, another generation of them, if we aren't dead by then, be more alert to it.
Well,
or will they all be upper level employees of the place? And
the trouble with it is, it takes years and years for the damage to reveal itself. That's the problem.
Well, you know, I wonder about my brother and I. We were raised in Lawrence, across from the little research nuclear reactor.
Lawrence?
Yeah, next door. Yeah, Kansas.
Oh, okay.
45 miles away on the university campus, and we were across the street from the nuclear reactor. That was, you know, a little experimental reactor, and I never knew what they did. You know, they built it after we built our house. And I thought, well, we both had at least one kind of cancer, so did Mother. Now she lived to be 97, but, you know, is there a connection?
It's an experimental reactor? Is that what
you're saying? Research.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You need to find out.
I did, you know. And, you know, it's a past tense for me in terms of my own health, but you wonder. So.
Yeah.
And there are, I mean, right next door, yeah, it was a fraternity built after it was built.
How long would it take to see effects of something like what's happening out in Colorado with these new buildings and the people living in them?
Years, 20, 30 years.
20, 30 years.
Yeah. The leukemia can develop within 4 years. That's the fastest thing. But leukemia doesn't always occur. You can have damage that isn't leukemia. So when you have a big thing like Fukushima, you have thyroid disease and leukemias. But that takes 4 years. So we're approaching 4 years with Fukushima. But all the way up until that point, you will hear nothing but denials, that everything's safe, there's nobody is sick, nobody has died. That's a constant refrain. And even with Chernobyl, I mean, it took a long time until some guy, you know, they said, oh yeah, 27 people died in Chernobyl, but other than that, everything's fine. And then some Soviet researcher, I forget his name, he calculated there are 1 million people will die from Chernobyl because of the spread of this stuff. But that's it, you enter that, it's like through the looking glass, you know, it's like, who do you believe, how do you, it's all quite slippery.
Was Chernobyl ever cleaned up like it should have been?
No, there's a huge zone, forbidden zone, and I forget how big it is, but it's enormous. You can't clean it up. How do you clean up a forest? And that's true in Fukushima as well. You can't clean it up. And plus, in Fukushima, that fuel is still there, and it still needs to be cooled every day. So they're pulling the water out of the ocean to cool it, and they're trying to store most of the water, but they're building these tanks so fast, they're very thin.
There is no way.
No.
How much water can you store?
No, it's,
right.
It's yeah. But the real problem, I mean, the problem is one of physics, but the other problem is one of denial and misrepresentation, like the Japanese industry. They don't even want anybody in there looking at what they're doing. And this is a world-class problem. They should be inviting experts from all over, but they're not doing that.
Mm.
So who knows what's happening to the ocean and the fish and the seaweed. It's at a certain point, it's simply impossible to tell. No person can say. It's depressing. But what do you do? You can't just roll over and die and turn off your brain, you know. But you can actually. But so far, to me, I still have the hope that if you take the right kind of picture, you know, it can communicate something to people. And but it's a guess, you know, it's a bet. But that's what I've been doing. For me, that's just what I've somehow, that's what I'm supposed to do.
You do what you can.
Yeah, you do what you can in your own way. That's why this worldwide referendum on the bomb from Kansas City is so exciting. That's doable. You could do that.
I think with the internet, ask
sure.
people just to vote once.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
I mean, there's a local young person, Martin, I can't remember what his last name is, part of the community here, who had some referendum, some poll that he did among the also Unitarian people. And so I'm going to need to like look at the wording of that, and maybe we'll get some steam behind it to take it far and wide.
Cool.
Well, I think with the activism that goes on at all the various sites, Y-12 and I just still can't believe that really there hasn't been a link together for one big movement of awareness, and I think it's still kind of being formed, but I don't know, with the internet and exposure, I'm just so exhausted with seeing, what's the word? 400,000 likes on something that really to me is really important but not meaningful, and then yet I see individuals that just kind of keep pounding the pavement and you get 1,200 likes. It's like, I'm amazed, and I still think that we're on a mission. Everybody's part, everybody, your photographs, you know, speak many, many words. Thousands of words, you know, I don't know how it can formulate into something that really gets the attention nationwide, worldwide. I don't know. What do you think, Mike? What else can keep being done? You know, our footsteps here are powerful and meaningful in what happens here, but somehow we're not kind of linking together. I think it's possible, so.
Yeah, I agree. It's just, it's like that 100th monkey or whatever that we...
Yeah. You can't predict it, but it's out there. You know, the word zeitgeist, you know? At a certain moment, things change. Look what happened with gay rights, you know? Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, it was a new day, and nobody predicted it. Look what happened to the fall of the Soviet Union. You can't know that, and you don't have to, you can't keep waiting for that to happen. It's like you have to give up on that. Just go forward anyway. Because there's something bigger out there somehow that is, and I think nuclear weapons is the perfect issue. I mean, global warming is a good one too, but nuclear weapons is deeper even. And that's why this worldwide referendum would be very interesting, just to get people to answer yes or no.
Yeah.
Couldn't be simpler. But then what would the numbers look like of 6 billion people? How many?
Right.
Yeah. But you're right, the internet seems to be the vehicle, you know, that we didn't have. But you won't get there by likes, because they
right.
don't like
just
anything.
Inappropriate word.
Well, no, but that's the word
I was
they
digging,
use.
You know, I'm still processing kind of everything.
I like kittens.
Really?
Batting balls at dogs, that's great.
Yeah. Just think of the years the tobacco industry
yeah.
had information. They
yeah.
paid their own scientists to write
yeah.
Scientific papers that would, you know, taint. It's not just smoking, it's carbon in the air from automobiles and
yeah.
x-rays that you had at the dentist office, or all those kind of things to throw mud, you know, in the gears. But
yeah, asbestos industry too.
Yes,
that was very clear, and it took decades still for it to. So that's it. That's the human race. That's where we're at. There's a wonderful. I teach animation, and one of the early animators is Winsor McKay, who did Little Nemo in Slumberland. Wonderful, beautiful script. And before that, he did this thing called Dreams of a Rarebit Fiend. Rarebit is a cheese dish made with beer. And if you eat a lot of it, you have hallucinations. That's the story. So he has these one-page things where things just, everything possible goes wrong. Terrible nightmares. And then the guy wakes up at the end and he says, I knew I shouldn't have eaten that rarebit. But he has one image that I've isolated and saved, and it's a man like this wading through a sea of, it looks like molasses. He's just pulled down. He's in glue, and he can barely move. And I think that's how we are, you know, at a certain point. When we stop being children, we're like mired in this thing. And that has to be okay, that we're like that. The question is, okay, given this, what can we do? What do we do? We can't fly, that's for sure. But where do we go? And when we're mired down with all these things collectively, and we just are. But I don't know, somehow this seems to be always possibilities, somehow. The world is full of surprises.
And sometimes it's merely an educational tool that will then snowball.
I'd like to believe that. I have beginning to wonder about it, but I'm a firm believer in that. Yeah. If only people had the right information.
Right.
But that's why I like photographs, because they're not, it's emotional. It goes deeper than information, you know. Mm-hmm. You could hear, oh, the Kazakhs were opposed to nuclear testing, so, and they won. That's one piece, but to see that photograph of those faces of the people, it's like, that's something else. I was there, when people give a speech in Kazakhstan, outside they talk for 2.5 hours. They have a different culture. I was trapped. It was crowded. I was trapped in a circle of people, so I had nothing to do but look at these faces for a couple of hours. So I very carefully studied, had all the time in the world, and that's the shot that I got, was all those people.
I bet you've had some incredible adventures as a photographer.
Yeah. The hardest thing is the idea to go there. You know, and when the Soviet Union dissolved, all these opportunities opened up, and you just had to jump there. We're leaving March 17th. Are you in? It'll be $1,900. And yes. And then you find yourself on an airplane, and there you go. The funniest adventure ever was at the Semipalatinsk test site. That's like our Nevada test site. Okay. And a whole busload of foreign journalists, the first time any foreign journalists had ever been admitted to this site. And they let us out, and we just spread out like this, because there's all kinds of things to photograph. And then I went out the furthest of anybody, because I kept looking for different things to take pictures of. And this big truck with a megaphone came by, saying something in Russian. And I heard one word, autobus. So Russian, autobus. So that means it's time to go back. Mm-hmm. So I sat in the front seat of this car, and they're trying to get everybody to go back. It was like herding cats. and I said, I'll do it in English for you. So they gave me the microphone. It was like an absolutely unique opportunity. Microphone in the semi-office with a big thing. So I would say, we would like to thank you for photographing the pure evil of nuclear weapons, please return to the autobus, or we'll be forced to raise the radiation level in your area. And I would make up stuff like this, and the guys didn't know what I was saying. And then we met for lunch afterwards, and people were talking, did you hear what that guy was saying? It was so much fun. And I had a kind of broken Russian accent, and it was great. My life as a comedian. Yeah, I had some adventures. But I'll tell you what, though, about adventures is almost every place I go, I meet at least one really good activist. Mm-hmm. That says, okay, you got to go over here, talk to Charlie. He'll tell you something, you know. That's always just invaluable. You can only do so much by yourself in a new place. Mm-hmm. You might have all the issues, you know, swirling around in your head, but you need to get it down, meet the individual people, get that story.
I am encouraged in my adventures by the youngsters. Well, they're called millennials. I heard they didn't like to be called millennials. But this group that's about 20 years old, they seem to have a mentality that is not only more energetic than old folks like me, but is also more adamant than I was 50 years ago. A kind of, let me just put it into a question instead of trying to make a statement. What about your exposure in the things that you do with your photographs and whatnot? What about your exposure to the 20-year-olds? How do they affect you?
Well, I teach mm-hmm. at the university. I teach the history of animated film. Mm-hmm. And two-thirds of the people in the class of 80, two-thirds of them are animators, so they're highly motivated. And yeah, they're 20, 18, 19, yeah. 20, uh-huh. 21. I really like working with them. I think they don't have any of the weight in the baggage that older people do, you know, World War II and Vietnam, all that stuff. They know about climate change. Mm-hmm. But they bring very fresh energy any project, you name it, they'll just go right after it because they don't think that the human race is doomed, you know. It's tricky, you have to navigate it, but it's not doomed, whereas those of us who've come through and saw so many lost opportunities think, well, you know, not looking very good, you know. So, but I pick films. We have a class and on documentary, animation in documentary, a little known, explored part of animation. And I show this film, How We Nuked the Earth 2,000 Times. Have you ever seen that film? Wonderful film. It's a graph of the world like this. And he does a little pinpoint of light. You can find it on YouTube. How We Nuked the World 2,000 Times. And a little point of light for every nuclear explosion. And he has a grid up on top of what year it happened and how powerful it was. And so it starts out really slow, Trinity, then Hiroshima, Nagasaki, then in the Marshall Islands, blah, 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 blah. And at a certain point, it's Russia comes in, and you see the Russian part light up, and then France, and then England, and at a certain point in the late 50s, the 60s, the whole place is just going off like a Christmas tree, and then it kind of subsides, but meanwhile, the numbers keep going, and so it ends up at around 2000. And it's devastating. It's very simple, though. But it's just like, wow, I had no idea. And the point is that this is a nuclear war. Mm-hmm. You drop a bomb, it's a nuclear war. You don't get to say it's just testing. It's very real. Every place where a bomb goes off, it becomes, by that very act, a high-level radioactive waste site. Because mm-hmm. the sand fuses, and it's all these fission products, and you can't go there anymore. And so we have 2,000 of these all over, except for the ones in the ocean. That's another
story. Those count too.
They do indeed. But anyway, I show that to my class, and they don't know anything about that. And that really hits them hard.
Yeah.
I'm not doing it to depress them, but I'm saying, you know, here's animation and this documentary, and thought you might want to know about this. So I can see that some of them appreciate it. But a lot of people, they don't want to see so much bad news, you know. That's human condition, I guess. You don't.
Robert?
Yes?
Do you believe that World War III is already ongoing with, you know, the contamination from the mining of uranium and the milling, the manufacturing, the processing? People being contaminated, the nuclear waste that are transported across the country, so many different ways that people, you know, are affected by nuclear materials and other things.
It has not occurred to me to call that World War III, and I don't see what difference it makes if you put that label on it or not. It doesn't seem like a...
Wouldn't it alert people?
It seems like a war, but I mean, it seems like a creeping thing. It's more like a plague, you know. A plague is not the same as a war, although you have end up with a lot of people who get killed. I don't think it's a war, because it's a war is very intentional, at least to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
But it's certainly not good news. That's for damn sure. What I don't like is the nuclear industry just insisting on the role of nuclear energy and climate change and all that. It's just, it's such a lie. But they just keep going. Nothing will stop these people from talking about how they have to build more nuclear power plants. And that doesn't seem right. Yeah.
And what are your thoughts on the agreement with Iran?
Well, I think it's a good agreement. I'm glad they did it. It seems to me a lot better than nothing. And although we can't control what Iran does with the money, it is their money after all, and we did get this agreement out of it. But I think it's good. I'm glad that it happened. What do you think about it?
Well, I don't know. I just don't know if they really, in the end, I mean, how they're going to build them anyway. Are we going to build them anyway? That seems to
we're
be
gonna build
the
them.
Thought.
Yeah, we are.
We are,
know,
for sure.
So
nothing will stop us. Well, if they are going to build them anyway, it's going to take them a lot longer. Mm-hmm. So that's worth something. I don't know what, but it's all kind of up in the air. But what about Israel? They've got like 100 nuclear weapons. Nobody ever talks about them.
That's a secret.
Yeah, yeah.
They're too smart to use them. In the 90s, there was an exhibit at Smithsonian, Enola Gay.
Yes, I know about that story. Yes.
And
yeah, very controversial, right?
Well, I saw the exhibit, and actually you got to go on the plane and see the plane. It wasn't very big.
No.
But the people that went to the exhibit, the day I was there, were almost all Oriental. I don't know if they were from Japan.
Probably.
Or China, or where they were from. Do you think that those people that were in the exhibit are still exploring the past? They don't know what happened. You know, are they? Did they know exactly what took place in World War II? Because we firebombed Japan. I mean, there were more casualties in the firebombing
Tokyo,
than it was
right.
in the two.
Yeah.
In the two bombs.
66 cities got firebombed.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Germany too. Dresden,
yeah.
And Hamburg. Mm-hmm. I've never been convinced by the numbers thing, though. You know, it's like only 80,000 died in Hiroshima and you had 100,000 die in Tokyo. To me, it's a different order altogether of energy. And although only 80,000 died, it started the Cold War and spread nuclear weapons worldwide. So that didn't happen with the firebombing. So I think to simply focus on the numbers is misleading. It's like comparing checkers with hyper chess, you know, or something. It's a different orders of magnitude involved. Plus, many more people died from Hiroshima over time, from the trauma and the radiation. And then if you count the deaths due to just simply the mass production of nuclear weapons due to radiation exposure and the leakage in the communities, the number quickly rises. So anyway, you had a question.
So are they exploring their past because they don't know what happened in the past for sure? that history has been erased, and the ones that are growing up don't really know, you know, what actually happened in the past with what came up to that event.
You mean like the Japanese militarism and
right,
Nanking
right.
and all that? Yeah, I heard that was kind of left out of the textbooks, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, although I think that's changing. I can't speak for those people. I don't know. I guess it'd be on an individual basis. But I know people were not happy with the fact that they removed all references to the suffering of the Japanese in Hiroshima. You know, but you're right. That people tend to leave out the extreme militarism that was behind. You know, the need to destroy Japan.
We had a professor come from the East, I don't remember his name, but he talked about the atomic bomb. His theory was, if Truman had not been elected president, would we still have dropped the bomb? And he came to the conclusion, it wouldn't have mattered who
I agree.
Was elected
no,
president,
yeah.
We would have dropped the bomb.
Truman didn't really decide, he just kind of... Yeah, he didn't have much say in it. No, the momentum was so enormous, nothing would have stopped it. That seems
yeah.
evident.
$2 billion in World War II money was spent on the Manhattan Project. And when you read a book that a person that was with the intelligence agency, Japan went through the Vatican. Vatican was ready to do a press release in May of 1945, and then it got pulled back because a press release said Japan surrenders unconditionally, you know, war is over. And of course the Japanese also tried to go through Russia and Switzerland for give up the war. But some people say, well, you know, we put all these terms, these things, we wanted to see what would a nuclear weapon truly be like.
They really wanted
And that
to
is
see.
Really horrific.
Yeah.
The scientists that were involved in Los Alamos They took, of the 150 main scientists, they took a survey, and 10% said, use it at all means. Do not, you know, even give them warning. 10% said never use it. Then the other 80% were split. 40% said do a demonstration in Japan,
right,
so they can see the effects.
Right.
The other 40% said do a demonstration in the United States, where Japanese people would come over to see the effects. And so recently I was at a restaurant, and this, my wife knew this lady, and he said, my uncle worked on the Manhattan Project. He was at the University of Chicago. And he said the scientists were upset after these two bombs were used because there was no attention paid to their survey and what their wishes are. And he said the scientists went on strike. He said, well, we're not going to do any more of this work, but the war was over, so...